session number 9483, reel 11.
Mr. Templer, Reel 11. Mr. Templer, you were telling us about the telephone exchange that you and Philip built.
Yeah. Well, we made a box-like structure and cut circular holes so that we put in one earphone into it and wired it up at the back. And for each post, I forget how many posts there were, about five or six, might have been seven, in various parts, some miles away from us, some as far as Leith Hill and around there, and to the outskirts of Dorking, so that it covered a wide area, and that meant that we had to run telephone lines, and in doing that we were fortunate enough to get a lot of rubber and insulated steel with a wire with a copper core running through the centre of it, rather similar to some of the last of the telephone lines that we used in France. At one time they were very easily broken, but these were better. And by using a transformer which magnified the power of vibration of the buzzers and voices, by using a single wire and then putting one wire onto the one telephone at each place, and then from the return circuit at each post and every point that we were speaking to and from, we used a copper earth pin, which was probably about 15 inches long, with a terminal on it, and we put an earth wire from that earth pin onto the return side of each telephone, you see, so that you had, instead of using two lines, which was common to begin with in France, we were able to work on one line with an earth pin in the ground to complete the telephone circuit in each case, and it worked very well. Because the people on the outer posts who weren't signalers only had to press a thing like a bell push, and it made a buzz in the earphone at the exchange that represented them. And therefore, by having a short lead plug with a plug at each end, we could plug it into our own telephone and plug it into their telephone, and we could speak to them from the base. And then if they wanted to speak to one of the other stations, like the area commander who was some miles out in the other direction, all we had to do is to buzz him and then plug the end of the short lead across to them, and they were speaking to each other.
So this was actually more sophisticated than the arrangement that you had in the first tour in France, where you didn't have a switchboard as such, did
That's
you?
That's right, we didn't there. But that was because we were connected through the division or the companies. But no, it was at the front, you couldn't do that sort of thing, except when we're at the divisional headquarters, where we were in communication, and then we were aligned to them.
Anyway, so you built up this system with the Home Guard. You had five or seven outposts.
Yes, and I had quite a number of men sent to me for training. I suppose 25, 30 men. I can't remember now. Might have been more. I never stopped to count them. In fact, I'll show you a card that one of them painted for me. I'll show you in a minute before you go.
I'm surprised that parts and wires and so forth were so readily available at a time of war. Was it difficult to get hold of the bits and pieces that you needed?
Well, I certainly bought some of them myself, but I didn't make any song and dance about that. But the wire was most important, and it came, I think, from a firm of cable manufacturers who had their government inspectors go in there and they'd test the full length of the line. Well, now sometimes the wire was in it was a very long spool, very long drum that it was on, you'd get bad made joints or no joint at all. And but running out a single line as we did, if we run it to our post from the exchange and we didn't get contact, we had to check along the line until we found where that fault was. When we cut it, cleaned the ends, made a joint, insulated it, and we got through all right then. So we turned a useful or a damaged sort of faulty cable into a useful telephone.
So you were using seconds, basically?
Yes, and the section had to come out. I told them when they started that they'd have to work bloody hard, because there was a lot to learn and a lot to do if we were going to be any good in defence. And so they'd come out every Saturday and Sunday that I would call for them. I wanted a lot. When I got this wire coming along, I wanted sewing machine cotton reels, you know, that they, you know, like the reel that you have cotton on. And I bought a lot of 4-inch nails or 6-inch nails, and they'd climb a telephone pole, get a ladder, or get up as high as they could, and they'd drive one of these long nails into the telephone pole or a tree, right through the hole of the cotton reel, and then I would show them how to make what we used to call a signaller's knot, which was a useful knot, which was, once you tied it, it didn't slip. And as it was an insulated bit of stuff, you would tie it there and then carry on to the next point where you wanted to make hitch up. It was a long job, but it did very well. And the old colonel who was in charge of our area, he was like a dog with two tails, you know. He was wagging it all the time. And he tried very hard to get me a gong, but I'd upset his superior, overall commander, because I think I've described it elsewhere, but I'd better tell you what it was. I'd got them out flag waving, because that's a good way to teach them Morse code. And they were on a slight gradient. The wind was blowing briskly and the flags were crackling and they were feeling so good, they were putting all their energy into it. I was got my back facing them, and suddenly I realised there was somebody standing behind me. And it was the overall colonel, the area. It was a very big area. I think it ran down to the coast almost. And he was the overall commander. He'd been a colonel in the regular army and served in India and got. He was a prisoner of war very early in France, I think, so he hadn't seen much fighting. Anyway, he said to me, "Oh, that is magnificent, Sergeant. I think you're doing very, very well indeed." I said, "Yes, sir, they're doing very well and they're trying very hard. But how long do you think it would take them to get a message through?" "How do I know? That's your job." And he hated me ever afterward. We'd come down periodically when we were running these lines round, and he'd see me and the men signallers on the road dealing with the wire. And on one occasion I was bent over a portable set that I'd made up, and I was speaking to one of the posts, and he stopped behind and he came over to me and he said, "Can I have a speak to them?" I said, "Yes, sir." So I handed him over to him, and he said, "Oh, who's that?" "Oh, this is the commanding officer speaking." You know, I thought, "Oh, you old shithouse," you know. But I don't put that down. You may have done, I don't know. I said it very softly. Anyway, no, that's how that was. And of course, my immediate commander, he'd been in the Norfolk Regiment and he'd lost an arm in the First War.
What was his name?
Jickling, Colonel Jickling. I don't know how you spell it, but he lived at a little place called, quite a nice house called Smallborough in Bear Green. And he sent for me one day and he said, "How many miles of telephone wire did you run?" He said, "I want to know." I said, "Why do you want to know, sir?" I said, "I don't know how many miles we run. Miles and miles of it." I said, what do you want to know for? He said, well, I want to get you a gong, you know. I think you've deserved it. So he did his own job, he wrote in. But my friend who was right on top, he didn't like me at all, so he gave it to his orderly room sergeant. There was only one for the unit, one for the battalion. It was a big battalion, you see, carrying miles and miles of country. But that was another gong I didn't get. At two. I'm no worse off for it, though.
Can you tell me a bit about the organisation of the Home Guard? How often would you meet? What sort of area would you cover?
Oh, well, the platoon, there was a platoon officer in each area. The man who was my supposedly platoon officer, he was a neighbour. I don't know how they made him a lieutenant. I don't. He was, to my opinion, which is not very valuable. I was surprised. However, there he was, and he was a lieutenant, so that had to be that. But by and large, they were a mixed bunch. They were a mixed bunch of troops, so to speak, because they were gardeners or they were field workers or agricultural people, you see. The farmers themselves, I don't think, joined up, but their labourers probably did. And it was an interesting operation. And we had one or two, made one or two demonstrations, which I took part on one occasion, on how to attack an enemy and concealed in a copse and all that sort of lot. And it was the first time I did it, the troops were all very, very good, and they did exactly what I said. And now we were asked to do it again. And that was a flop. Didn't link up, no, but it was there, and I got them back all right. But the point was that it was not the same spontaneous effort that the first lot had been.
When you say it was a demonstration, who was the audience?
Oh, other people, other units, and mostly the local public. They wanted to see what we did.
So, in a sense, it was a morale-building exercise?
A morale-building exercise, yes. And the first time it happened, it was very good. And I suppose I became rather well-known around there.
How large was the platoon? How many men were there in it?
Oh, I don't remember now. I was with my signals, and eventually I was only in the with the platoon for a little while, and I was taking care of signals.
So actually most of your time was spent with the signal section?
That's right, building. I had to teach them, and we had a room at one of the pubs where we had buzzers and everything else going. We could go up there and spend as long as we like, even if we were a bit late going home, which was very often. We had a drink occasionally. And we were cycling at that time because the petrol was scarce. Phil and I, he joined the Home Guard before he was 18, you see. And then he learnt the Morse code and all that. And that's why when he said, I'm 18 now, Dad, they won't let me go to university. So what shall I do? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, what should you, if you were me, would you volunteer for anything? I said, well, there's only one sensible thing for you to do, my lad, and that is remember that my job as a signal sergeant was a very good job. And although I had a rough time and there was all sorts of dangers about, I wasn't as badly off as if I was in one of the companies as an infantryman. So why not try the Royal Corps of Signals? That's where he finished up. We went up to town together one day, and we went to their headquarters just off, not far from Buckingham Palace. And I went in with him, and he was interviewed and came back to me, and recruiting man sent a message for me. He'd like to have a word with me, and so that was it. And he eventually was trained as a radio mechanic.
But he'd already had some experience.
He had the Morse code
with
experience.
You, yes.
With me. And it made his pass fairly easy for there. And he was attached to one of the tank divisions, a battalion in one of the tank divisions. And he went to France with them. And eventually, after the European war ended, he was sent out to Palestine, still as a radio mechanic. And he came back in 46, I think it was, 47. I was very glad to see him back. I was very worried about it, because I know what the army can suddenly do to you. You can be pitchfork, you can be nice and comfortable for a while, and all of a sudden you're in the middle of trouble. No doubt about it. And of course, I've heard about one of the branches of the Royal Corps of Signals was caught up, so I think it was in Crete. They were more or less annihilated. No, he didn't go to Crete, he went with the tank division too. They went up for that to Arnhem business, but they didn't get there, they got stranded.
So the life of a signal is not always a safe one, not always a safe, comfortable one.
It isn't always a comfortable one, though. I assure you, in whatever field you're in.
With the Home Guard, did you feel it was likely that Germany were going to invade the country?
Oh, we had one or two scares. In fact, one night I had a telephone on my call on my home line, my own ordinary telephone, and they gave a code word. I think it bandits or something. I thought, of course, that means the Germans are parachuting. I remember going out and seeing had a shelter built there, and told them, my wife and the boys, to get in the shelter. And I jumped in my car, and then driving round lanes and without any headlights on is not funny. I got little hoods on them. I got round to Smallborough, it was up at Bear Green, the proper, and that was where the immediate commander was, and where I had headquarters signalers there too. And when I got there, I got the whole area standing too. And the word came through that it had been a mistake. It should have been, a mock. It was just a trial run. But they all got out, and there was a great deal of congratulation in the way that it was all got out because of our telephone system.
Was the telephone system manned 24 hours a day?
Hmm?
Was the switchboard of the telephone system hours a day?
Well, it was only at night. Night times, that was when there was trouble. But if there was anyone local there who knew anything about it, there they could use it if it was necessary. But then I was up in town then, and doing my normal work. But at weekends, of course, there were more people about anyway. But they don't always attack at weekends, do they?
at night time, you always had someone.
There was always someone every night on duty there.
And you would patrol at night, would you?
Hmm?
Would you patrol at night?
I used to patrol there. But first, we carried out 12 bore guns. They'd make a nasty hole in anyone if he's near enough. And I had one experience of one of my neighbours who turned up with his 12 bore gun, and he was talking to me about what would happen. He'd never been in the army. So I said, well, you just plug them, you've got your gun. I said, haven't you got any cartridges with you? He said, no, I just bought my gun. I said, bloody well, go and get some cartridges then, if we're likely to have any trouble, so you better load it. So he went to his little house, and got a pocket full of cartridges, and he, under my immediate instruction, I was a sergeant at the time, he loaded up, which I thought was a very sensible thing to do, because if you carry a gun, it's no bloody good if you can't use it. You're liable to be shot for just carrying it. That's my philosophy anyway. I always like to shoot first.
Finally, Mr. Templer, can you tell us whether you feel service in the Great War had any effect on your subsequent life?
I do. For one thing, I'm perfectly certain that it made a great deal of difference to my outlook on life, and I think that once you've been shot at and in very great danger of being killed on more than one occasion, life becomes very precious to you. And I wouldn't have missed the experiences for the world in the view that I had survived. And moreover, I am sure that it had a great deal of influence on my married life. I think Daze and I were both very grateful for the fact that I had survived. And I think that this is a very important matter, because all our married life, she wanted to be involved with anything that I was doing. We worked together and to build the business. We worked together in everything. And there were never any secrets between us. And I think there was a certain feeling of joy and gratitude in the fact that I had survived in order to enjoy it, for her and I to enjoy a married life together. So I think it did me a lot of good. It made me realise that what I had got to do was to provide. Whatever, it was no good sitting down and waiting for somebody else to do something for me. I had to get up and do it myself.
You've mentioned on a couple of occasions getting in touch with former comrades. Was there a feeling at the end of the war that you wanted to stay in touch with the people that you'd served with?
Well, there was not a lot of my original comrades left, really. But there was one down who lived down in Stroud, who came into our orbit many years afterwards. In fact, I think it was about 1952, just before Christmas. John himself was then running the family shop in 71 Abbey Road, St John's Wood, which was a provision and turkeys and all the rest of it, and a man walked into his shop that Christmas Eve, and asked if he'd got anything left suitable for a Christmas dinner. John told him that his stock of turkeys had all been sold. They were all sold and waiting delivery. But he had one or two brace of pheasants left. Would a brace of pheasants suit the purpose? The customer said, yes, it would, providing you can pluck them and dress them ready for the oven. So Jen said, well, providing you can wait, that can be done. So the customer said, all right, I'll take a brace of pheasants. And John gave them in to his man, who was working in what they used to call the block, where they did all that sort of work. And while the birds were being prepared to be taken away, John stood and talked to this fellow. He said, where are you going then for Christmas? He said, oh, it's a place you wouldn't know, a little village called Brimscombe, down near Stroud in Gloucestershire. John said, well, that's very strange, because I had a pal in the army who came from there. And he said, oh, what was his name? And he said, Harold Buckingham. And he said, oh, was he a chippy in civil life? John said, I think he must have been, because that was what I always had the impression. And he said, well, I should be seeing him over Christmas. So they exchanged addresses, and John told him that I was married to his sister, and that I was the sergeant, NCO, the sergeant in charge of the battalion signalers, and would know Harold Buckingham. So the fellow went away with the view of talking to Harold Buckingham over the Christmas. And early in the new year, Dave and I were down in that area. I forget, I'd taken some show cards or matter for some of our customers down there. And as we were nearby, we decided to call in at Harold Buckingham's house. And we met his wife, who talked to us about parochial matters only. And it was rather amusing. But it meant that we'd contacted, I heard one or two things, several of the old signalers had died, apparently, even in that short time. And we kept in touch. We sent each other letters and cards and that over the years, Christmas cards and that sort of thing. And then just about the time that my wife died, just after that, I had a letter from a woman down in Brimscombe telling me that Harold Buckingham also died. So I think he was died about the day that my wife was buried. So she said she felt that she knew me. You've probably seen the letters of that, have you? And I rang her up and she said, I said, darling, I can send you some money. What would you like me to do with it? You know, I said, well, that's up to you. And sent her some money, via Reef or whatever she wanted. And she wrote and told me what she'd done, and how the flowers had been disposed of, and they went to taken to the church and to the hospital after they'd been on the grave for a while. And, it was all very interesting. And she also, and then she said, he was always talking about you. I feel I knew you. I felt I knew you, although he never met me. And it turned out that it was because of what I did in that last battle that all the men were upset that I hadn't been received the medal. And it was that thing. Because when I used to walk through the camp after I returned from the hospital, I sometimes had to be called to the order room to go and see the colonel. And as I walked through the camp, what few were left would see me, and they'd all stop talking together and watch me. They were talking about me. I felt that. I knew that's what they were doing. And so this lady from Brimstone said that's what they must have been doing, because everybody was disappointed that you hadn't been received recognition. That's the end of my story.
Thank you very much indeed.